Okay, I would like everyone to reconvene to the dais, please. Thank you. So we move now to item 10, which is to reopen a hearing with concluding statements in considering adopting administrative civil liability order for the Carpinteria Sanitary District in Santa Barbara County. So we will start with the prosecution team, and we have provided a 15-minute time allocation for your presentation, after which our board members can ask for questions, and then I will use the same process for the defense. Yes, Mr. Harris.
So I just want to remind those who will be speaking, we do have a court reporter. We'd like you to speak slowly. If you could provide her with your business cards before you leave, and any written material that you are using or referring to, if you could also provide her a copy of that. And I would ask the court reporter, if you need someone to repeat anything or they're going too fast, just let us know.
Yeah, and another request I think made is because of the line of sight is a little bit limited, is that when we ask questions, just briefly state our name. You still would like us to do that? Okay. Very good. Please proceed.
I guess that's my cue. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board, for this opportunity. My name is David Boyers. I am counsel in this matter for the prosecution team. I appreciate the opportunity to summarize the comments that we provided on the board's draft revised order for the Carpinteria matter. And in those comments, we really try to focus our thoughts on the one area that we thought was most important, and that is with respect to the staff cost language. And if you're following along, that language can be found on page 15 of the order. It's particularly related to step 7 of the penalty methodology. The board's proposed revisions here suggest that the enforcement policy obligates the prosecution team to prove that its costs are reasonable and in the interest of justice, and that these two criteria will be judged in part by comparing the amount of the staff costs with the penalty amount ultimately imposed. And in our comment letter, I think we tried to identify the two problems that we see with this approach. The first is that the language and the standards described are not consistent with the express language in the enforcement policy. And the second is that the revisions create an incentive for the discharger to drive up the costs so that the ratio between costs and penalties ultimately makes the costs seem unreasonable. So first, looking at the consistency issue, the policy uses the term reasonable only once in relation to legal costs. And it says specifically, quote, legal costs reasonably attributable to the enforcement action should be imposed. And I think the idea here is that an attorney, as they do, may spend a number of hours researching legal issues that may come up during the course of the investigation or the course of preparing the complaint. And those legal issues may take sort of odd turns here and there, and so that the costs associated with an attorney, I'll say, spinning his wheels or going on tangents are not reasonably attributable to the enforcement action and should not be imposed. And I'll liken these sort of the billable hours if you're an attorney working on a case for a client. However, the enforcement policy discusses staff time differently, and in contrast, it talks about staff time collecting evidence, drafting the complaint, preparing testimony, putting on a hearing, are all costs that are directly attributable to the violation and would not otherwise be incurred. And the policy very clearly identifies that these specific costs should be added to the liability amount. So I think these are different than the legal costs, and that sort of qualifier language applies only to the legal costs and not to the other staff costs. With respect to the standard of in the interest of justice, the enforcement policy states that adding staff costs is in the interest of justice. It makes that assumption. It says, quote, the costs of investigation and enforcement are other factors as justice may require and should be added to the liability amount. And here, I think the policy is expressly recognizing that justice is served by making those persons responsible for the violation bear the financial burden to the state incurred by responding to and prosecuting the violation. So turning now to the incentives issue, again, we would urge the board to reconsider this idea that the amount of staff costs that are appropriate should be considered in relation to the penalty amount. And having done a lot of enforcement cases during the time that I've been at the Office of Enforcement, we often see small dollar penalty cases that deserve and warrant a large number of staff time and costs, given the legal issues and, frankly, how much fight we get from the discharger. And it really is the discharger that has the ability to control, in part, how many staff costs and time is spent. You know, do we demand things that are unreasonable? Do we demand a hearing? Those sorts of things, you know, may not necessarily reflect the reasonableness of the time spent in preparing the enforcement matter. Finally, in our comment letter, we asked the board to recognize the important relationship that this region has had with the Sacramento Office of Enforcement staff. The limited resources of this region with respect to the enforcement are not enough to bring the matters before you that need to be brought. And Sacramento staff have assisted this region in bringing matters to you that may not have otherwise appeared. Finally, we've provided you with two options, of proposed revisions. The first would allow staff to recover some of the $22,000 that was proposed at the hearing. We think that $10,000 is an appropriate amount if you were to grant us that, and we've proposed some language that would recognize that. The second option basically would find that the deterrent effect alone of the underlying penalty is sufficient, and while the board generally supports staff costs, it doesn't recommend them in this particular case. There was one typo or error in our second option, which I will point out now in the letter, and that's on page 3 at the bottom. The second line up from the bottom, the phrase, when reasonably attributable to the enforcement action, should have been a strike through, as we did in our first option. And with that, I will close and be happy to respond to questions.
Thank you. Mr. Johnston.
Thank you. Just finding the right page here. In the district's comments on the draft order, they took issue with a statement in attachment A that says a discharge of treated undisinfected wastewater poses less potential risk than untreated sewage, but secondary treatment alone does not reduce pathogens significantly. And they took issue with the latter part of that, but secondary treatment alone does not reduce pathogens significantly. And they stated that that was not supported by any evidence presented to the board. I haven't looked at a transcript. Maybe, can you refresh my memory? Was that in fact that statement that secondary treatment alone does not reduce pathogens significantly supported by evidence presented to the board?
Frankly, I hadn't gone through the transcript and looked for whether there was evidence that would support that statement. I don't know that it's necessary to add that in order to support the findings of the order.
Thank you.
Any other question? All right. So And the question is from Mayor Delgado.
Mayor Delgado, you have to speak closer to the mic. We can't hear you.
I'll start by turning it on. So on page 7 of the resolution, it goes to costs or assessment liability fees, and it mentions, as we know, $64,000 was recommended for the discharge and $15,000 for MMPs, and that totals something probably close to $80,000. But then in the next paragraph, it says make a check payable in the amount of $64,000. So is the $15,000 supposed to be paid by some other check? Looking at page 7.
No, it says in the next paragraph, the discharger shall submit a check payable to the State Water Board cleanup and abatement account in the amount of $64,800.
Oh, I didn't see the $49,000. So we're talking about 49 plus 15, not 64 plus 15.
Correct.
That's my confusion. Okay, thank you. Sorry about that.
And just on the record, Mr. Chair, I don't think we mentioned that Mr. Young is not part of this deliberation because he was not here in May. So I think we should just clarify the record.
Yep. Good point. Thank you.
That's true. I'm not voting on this. I didn't participate in it. I wasn't involved in the deliberations, most importantly. And I haven't reviewed anything except what was in the staff report, but I'm not voting on this.
Thank you. So I would like now to turn, yes, Ms.
Going back to Board Member Johnston's questions, we've had some sort of side discussions here, and we would like to try to address the evidence at the hearing that might support that. And I'll turn it over to Harvey Packard.
This is Harvey Packard, the enforcement team. I don't know if we have any direct evidence in the record that shows the relative reduction in pathogens during secondary treatment, but there is evidence in the record that shows the amount of pathogens in secondary effluent. That was in our brief, and it shows a fairly high amount of pathogens in secondary effluent. So if that gets at your question, that information is in the record.
So if I understand correctly, you're saying there's information in the record that there is significant levels of pathogens in secondary treated sewage, but not necessarily evidence in the record that secondary treatment alone does not reduce pathogens significantly. There's not a comparison to the non-secondary treated.
That's accurate.
Thank you.
Okay, so I would like now to have give a 15-minute opportunity to the defense team.
Good morning. William Carter on behalf of the Carpinteria Sanitary District. With me at the table is General Manager Craig Murray. I do have a slide that we're going to present. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. We really appreciate the patience and attention you've paid to this matter, which we believe is very important. It's very important on behalf of the district, not for financial reasons, not for economic reasons, not for the penalty at stake, but rather for what we believe to be the credibility and the integrity of this enforcement process. My intent during our brief time is to talk about the two issues we raised in our comments. One is whether this action has been taken against the district is consistent with the enforcement policy, and whether or not the prosecution team has met its burden as to whether there was harm or potential harm. We would submit, and therefore whether it supports the score of 2 for both factors 1 and 2. The district submits that the answer to both of those questions is no. More importantly, and unfortunately, we think that in this process, the burden has been shifted to the district to disprove the allegations. We believe there's been a lot of presumptions, there's been a lot of assumptions about whether or not there was harm or not, and whether or not it's consistent with the enforcement policy. And unfortunately, as we read the draft ACL, it seems to be that burden has been shifted to the district rather than put on the prosecution team. You heard my colleague and the prosecution team talk about his enforcement background. I didn't mention this before, but I've spent my entire 30 years as an attorney in environmental enforcement. I've been a city attorney, a deputy district attorney. I've been an assistant United States attorney, and I've been an environmental crimes prosecutor for nearly 30 years. At one point, I was appointed by the governor to be the first general counsel of Cal EPA. I was also the first person to be the head of law enforcement for Cal EPA back in the mid-90s, which actually drafted some of the initial enforcement policies for this and many of the other Cal EPA agencies. Now, you may say, this guy can't keep a job. But that's not what I've seen. I think from that perspective, I've seen traffic tickets, ACLs, civil cases, criminal cases, and I've put people in federal prison for doing some very bad things environmentally. So I think I have a very broad spectrum of what enforcement is. And I sincerely and strongly believe in aggressive, fair, and consistent enforcement. That's what keeps people in line. That's what sets deterrence. And hopefully we don't have to prosecute everybody, but just those that are the worst. Unfortunately, what I've seen here is neither fair nor consistent. And I think the credibility of this process is at stake here. And I'm being very sincere here because, as we've said before, what's happened here is highly unusual. If you impose an ACL in this matter for this particular type of case, it will be the first time this regional board has ever done that in our review, as we've said. And it's done it in a way that we think is frankly unfair. The district is willing to pay an appropriate fine, and we're willing to take our lumps for this particular conduct. We've never denied doing it. But this is a precedent-setting case. This will be the first time we understand that a loss of disinfection case like this has ever been, a discretionary ACL has ever been taken for this type of action. And we return to the first question I asked when I spoke here in May. Why? Why is this matter here? Now, we at one point, we talked about whether it could be an MMP or ACL. We understand that, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. But we believe the prosecution should be asked that question. Why is this case here? They've never explained why this case is here. And I think they have the burden to do that. As I read the enforcement policy, the prosecution team has to say, we're doing this action for the following reasons. You've asked that question in many other areas, and I'll get to that. In fact, on pages 6 and 7 of the draft ACL, the way I read it, you actually shift the burden to us to prove it's not consistent. We don't believe that's the proper. Rather, the prosecution team should prove whether it's consistent. In other words, as you said it on page 7, the board lacks adequate information about these other cases cited by us. We don't believe we have to do that. We believe once we raise those other cases, you should be inquiring of the prosecution team, how are these cases the same and how are they different? Why in those cases, which are similarly situated, but far worse in impact, why weren't they prosecuted or why weren't they taken to an ACL? We're not asking to be given a pass. We just think they have the burden. You did the same thing to the prosecution team when the prosecution team alleged that low dosage alarms, chlorine alarms, were standard industry practice. And I thought some of you were skeptical about that and you asked those questions. And on page 14 of your ACL, you pointed out, well, the prosecution team didn't prove that. In fact, they didn't ask anybody who else had these alarms. So there's a situation where you didn't take them on face value, you actually asked them. And I think you should ask them here as well. We think that's important because we can find no other similar case where there is a loss of disinfection by a public agency, like in this situation where they've been brought up on an ACL. And again, we're not trying to get a pass. We just think what you're doing is so unusual, you should inquire of the prosecution team as to why they're doing it. And what's important is you see that slide. You can see all the way towards the end on the right where the green arrow is. That's where Carpinteria Sanitation District is. Look at how many or few violations they have, and it's 8.
Can we see that slide? I'm sorry. Can it be shown full size? That's it. Thank you.
So as you've heard before, Carpinteria has an excellent enforcement compliance history. And there they are on the far right with 8 violations prior to this event. And yet they have been singled out for an ACL as opposed to some of the other folks on the left side. For example, El Estero has got 48 violations. Avila Beach had 56 violations. Cayuma, 8. South San Luis Obispo, 57. California Men's Colony, 415. El Estero, 48. Soledad Sewage Treatment Plant, 81. Those facilities had similar violations or worse, and they were not taken to task for an ACL. We just want to know why we were treated differently. And I think shifting to the enforcement costs, I think you, as the board, recognized there was something unusual here. Because in your, on page 15, when you talk about costs and not You stated there is no evidence that is in interest of justice or sound public policy in this case to penalize the district for the prosecution team's decision to use Sacramento rather than local staff to conduct site investigations. So here again is a situation where you did not impose costs for whatever belief you based that on, that they did not need to use Sacramento in this case. We've always believed that. We thought this was a very low-key, short-duration event, and it should not have been brought as an ACL. Shifting quickly to the factors 1 and 2, again, we don't believe that the prosecution team met its burden to show harm or potential harm. We thought the burden was shifted to us. We, in that case, we do believe even though it was shifted to us, we did rebut that presumption by bringing actual evidence of sample and modeling and showing you very succinctly through our expert that that discharge would have dissipated rather quickly, and therefore there would have been no harm under the 93-1 dilution. I'm going to defer to General Manager Craig Murray on the technical side of why we don't believe the prosecution team proved those factors should have a score of 2. But I will just leave you with this on that note. The 2A, it seemed to me that the prosecution team relied heavily on this shellfish harvesting number of 14 MPN and to allege or to presume that there was harm or potential harm. Well, I would tell you that the two agencies in the one primary agency, the pre-harvest shellfish unit of the Environmental Management Branch of the California Department of Health, they knew that there had been a discharge. In fact, in their calculations, if you look at Prosecution Team Exhibit 21, when that shellfish unit was aware of the discharge, they calculated or believed it was a 1 million MPN. They thought, they assumed it was a 1 million MPN. At 300,000 gallons in that location. And having said that or known that, they did not post the beaches. And this is the entity that is responsible for shellfish harvest enforcement. So they did not post the beaches, even on a calculation that was 10 times higher than the actual numbers we believe occurred. Also, the Santa Barbara County Department of Health, with that knowledge, didn't post the beaches. So we believe we rebutted the presumption or the assumptions that the prosecution team made. I'll defer now, but I'll return for a short comment at the end to Craig Murray. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Craig Murray, General Manager of the Carpinteria Sanitary District. And on behalf of my agency, I would like to thank you again for the opportunity to provide some input here.
Is your microphone on?
We have spent a lot of time looking at the enforcement policy. It's been in effect since 2010. One of the things that we looked to first way back in 2013 was Section 2B on page 6 of the policy. The language says, to the greatest extent possible, regional board shall target entities with class one priority violations for formal enforcement action. I would ask this board to look at the criteria in that policy for class one priority violations. In this case, a plain reading of that from our perspective suggests that not one of those criteria apply to this incident, and the only reasonable assessment of ranking would be a class three violation. So I haven't been able to reconcile that myself, and I hope that you do look at that. We spent a lot of time talking about the ACL penalty calculation methodology, specifically these step one factors one and two. Factor one score, and I'm quoting, evaluates direct or indirect harm or potential harm from the violation. And the board concurred in their ruling that the enforcement team score of two or below moderate, which states that impacts are observed or reasonably expected, harm to beneficial uses is minor. We continue to believe this score is inappropriate. And in our initial 13267 technical report, we had an independent expert, in environmental fate and transport, perform actual dispersion modeling for this incident. And their finding was that under reasonable maximum exposure scenarios, none of the events resulted in an exceedance of applicable water quality limits. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm trying to keep my time. Under reasonable maximum exposure scenarios, none of the events resulted in an exceedance of applicable water quality limits and no adverse impacts to human direct contact recreation or shellfish harvesting or aquatic life would be expected. Their technical analysis also determined that even in the worst case scenario, all ocean plan water quality objectives would have been met within approximately 20 seconds and 2 feet from the point of discharge. Based on this model data, surfers, swimmers, recreational shellfish harvesters, they simply could not have been impacted by this discharge in any reasonable interpretation. As you know, the enforcement team did not present any evidence to show that water quality impacts were actually observed or could be reasonably expected. The state's assertions regarding harm were based on conjecture and supposition. And Bill mentioned the shellfish unit didn't take any action, but also the County Department of Public Health didn't take any action once they got this information reported directly from the district. So I'm going to talk a little about the magnitude of the event. 160,000 MPN per 100 milliliters, that's the total coliform concentration that was in secondary effluent, undisinfected secondary effluent, that we voluntarily reported to the state as part of our initial response. And that sounds like a big number, and perhaps that value, that number, influenced some of the board's decisions. But for perspective, the total concentration of total coliform in raw sewage typically ranges between 1 million and 1 billion MPN. And I think you'd see values in that 160,000 range in stormwater or in San Luis Creek. So we presented this information initially really to be fully transparent, but also because in a comparative context, it's not an alarmingly high number. And it's borne out by the dispersion modeling that we did. There was no impact. I'll talk a little about the...
You need to
okay, I have just
wrap up because, sure. You know, I've allowed it 15 minutes, and I think you wanted to have a concluding remark. So in fairness and balance for everyone, you need to really shorten your... Give us a summary here.
Okay, at 30 seconds. Just with respect to the reduction of bacteria and pathogens in secondary treatment, it's absolutely false that secondary treatment does not reduce pathogens. In conventional wastewater treatment and at a plant like ours where we have extended aeration, it provides log removal, several orders of magnitude removal of bacteria and pathogens. And so I think that is not even in dispute in the literature or anything like that. So I guess at the bottom line, we really would ask this board to look again at those two factors. Factor two is very much the same as factor one. If you read the language that describes the criteria to select those factors, the district's strong belief is that it should be at the very least a ranking of one for factor one and two. And we certainly ask in the interest of justice that the board make the decision to have parity and to have fairness the application of enforcement in this region, and that the penalty calculation be modified to reflect those lower numbers. Thank you.
If I may briefly,
I'm going to give you 1 minute.
Thank you.
Okay.
I think you have to look at your draft ACL at page 4, because I think it distills down the whole issue here. The prosecution team has said that this matter does not qualify for an MMP because it's not serious. In other words, if we had discharged a more serious pollutant in group 1 or group 2, we might have qualified for an MMP and pay a $3,000 penalty. However, because this pollutant, total coliform, is not serious, we have to be kicked into a higher enforcement category of discretionary. So instead of paying $3,000 for a serious pollutant, we now to pay $45,000 for a non-serious pollutant. So how do you correct that? How do you correct that? How do you equalize that? Because we don't qualify because we're not serious. You can adjust those factors 1 and factor 2, reduce them to from a 2 to a 1 to really properly represent what this is. And that's how you arrive at a just and fair approach to this case. That's what this is about. Thank you very much, and I really appreciate the time and your attention. Thank you.
Thank you. So I open to a question from my fellow board members. We'll start on my left.
I'm your right.
Right.
No, I started on my left.
Oh, well, you got all the way to me already?
Yeah, absolutely.
I got no questions.
Mr. Chair, I do have one question I'd like to ask. Could you put up the slide with the numbers of violations? So the numbers here, just to be, I mean, you're seeing numbers, but you're not. It's not a. It's apples and oranges. It's not. It's very qualitative. You don't know what's behind the numbers. I just want to point out a lot of these are MMPs, I believe. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. So I just want to point out that, you know, what you're seeing are not, say, for example, spills. So it's not like California Men's College had 415 spills or anything equivalent to that necessarily. It's just, I just want you to be aware of what the numbers represent.
Thank you.
No response to that question?
Only if also prosecution would like to respond. I mean, counsel, what's your suggestion or recommendation, I should say?
I believe the EO phrased that as a question, but he wasn't actually making a question. He was making a statement.
Okay, all right.
I would object. It sounded like
well, I will.
My question was just to confirm with you that what the numbers included, and then I wanted to clarify for the board so they understood what the numbers meant, because I was I was concerned that there wasn't full disclosure on what the numbers meant behind the graph. So I just wanted to make sure the board understood that.
If the board wants a full clarification, we can have the person.
Here, Mike.
I'm sorry. If the board wants full clarification, we can have the person who put those numbers on there speak. It, and that's Mr. Murray.
Well, okay. If you can give me the Reader Digest version, I don't want to hear every single one of them, so just
Mr. Chairman,
give me the big picture.
I'd also like to respond to the question then, okay. Or any other questions that the discharger is responding to.
Okay, I'll be very brief. This data came out of the CWICS online monitoring system. These are reported violations between that period of time. And this slide was originally put together to point out that not a single one of those violations was, to this date, pursued as a discretionary penalty using the ACL penalty calculator. Every single one of those, if it was pursued as a violation, was treated as an MMP. And that was really the point of that slide.
Okay. Mr. Tom.
I just want, following on what Mr. Harris said about the what this slide is representing, there are, as you can see by the numbers, many, many violations. It represents millions of dollars in penalties assessed by the enforcement team. Millions of dollars in penalties are represented here. And each one of those dischargers at different times has said to us, you're picking on us.
Okay, thank you. So that clarifies. So at this time, we close the hearing, and we have two paths that we can take. One of them would be a vote or a deliberation, which would take place closed door, in a closed session, I should say. So these are the options that we do have. So I'm going to be asking my fellow board members to give me guidance on which direction you would like to take. I will start on my left. Are you basically ready for a vote, or do you still want to deliberate?
I am ready for a vote, and I would rather not continue deliberation in closed session because I haven't heard any new issues that we didn't digest thoroughly in the past meeting when we were here.
Okay. Dr. Hunter?
I would agree with Mr. Delgado.
Ms. Cervantes? Mr. Johnston?
I'm inclined to deliberate. I heard some things from, frankly, from both sides, from the prosecution and from the district, that I would be inclined to deliberate on. I may be a minority of one on that. I don't want to engage in a fruitless process. I'm not sure what you suggest, Mr. Chair.
In my case, I also, would be ready for a vote. I believe, would you like to comment? I see.
Since there is one board member that would like to enter into closed session, I would recommend that we do so.
Yeah, I thought that would be the case, in terms of the fairness of the process. So are you then formally requesting that we?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so then we will enter into a closed session, and we will reconvene upstairs. So thank you.
And Mr. Chair, for the record, I will not be participating in the closed session.
All right, we'll give you a break this time.
Fine.
It all depends how long, we're going to be deliberating.
You could put a time limit on it, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
What I would suggest is if it's going to run past noon or whatever, we can text the clerk and she can inform the audience.
Okay, let's do it that way.